Let's go around again and say, you know, why you've been invited to sit at this table today to talk about cowboy in this area as sort of myth and reality. Go ahead, Matt.
I'm Matt Mayberry. I'm the director of the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum. I'm a historian, and I focus on the history of the Pikes Peak region.
Kim. I'm Kim Walker. I'm a professor of digital film and media arts at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. And I teach a course in American cinema where Westerns are one of the genres that we study.
Anne. I'm Anne Hyde, and I teach history at Colorado College. And I teach a course on history of the American West, and I teach a Native American history course, and I teach a local environmental history course, and I teach Introduction to Southwest Studies. So that's the local piece.
Great. Our topic today is sort of the myth of the cowboy in the American West, and so I kind of want to start by examining what it actually means to be Western in as it relates to the American West. You know, what are those values? What do those things mean as far as part of American consciousness and identity?
Well, I think that's changed over time. I mean, it's I think prior to the Civil War and just after the Civil War, it meant settlement. It meant a chance to rebuild your life. I think that changes as you go through the decades, and the West becomes settled. It's now a place where you relocate to. It's an urban center. I mean, one of the definitions I've heard of the West is that it's more urban than any other part of the country, because there are fewer opportunities for agricultural activities because of the nature of the aridity of the West.
Go ahead, Anne.
Well, I to reiterate what Matt said, I think that a lot of it has to do with this reinvention of self, and I think that's a big image in film and literature as well, this notion that it's a sort of blank slate in which you can reinvent yourself. But I think that's where the sort of myth-reality problem enters in, because it never actually is a blank slate for all kinds of reasons.
Do you care to elaborate on why it's never really a blank slate?
Well, it's in the sort of old joke that wherever you go, there you are. So you bring yourself, but there's also this, you know, overpowering physical landscape. And actually, people already live there and always have already lived there. So you're trying to reinvent yourself in a very difficult physical place and a place that's already filled with people.
So let's talk a little bit about the characteristics of the cowboy. You know, what makes a cowboy as part of this myth, and where does it come from?
Well, to take a very local perspective, I always think, when I think of the myth of the West and the cowboy, I think of the Hank the Cowboy sculpture that's downtown in Colorado Springs, that some of you may know. It's at the corner of Pikes Peak and Tejon Street, and it's this slightly larger than life cowboy reading the Gazette Telegraph. And it's drawn from the Pikes Peak or Bust Rodeo and the range rider tradition here in Colorado Springs. But that's a wholly invented activity that really has very little to do with the tradition of Colorado Springs. And it actually, the local rodeo in Colorado Springs, evolved out of a flower parade, which I just love the juxtaposition between those two images. And so to me, I mean, certainly the cowboy is an iconic figure in the American West and belongs in the American West. I think it's somewhat difficult to really get a grasp of the cowboy tradition in the Pikes Peak region, and I think in other parts of southeastern Colorado. It just doesn't seem to fit here to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of that makes sense.
Sure. Where do you see either Kim or Ann the origins of this cowboy myth, and what are the characteristics as they've as they pertain to Colorado?
The best example I can think of, what I'm probably most familiar with, is the John Ford codification of the cowboy myth. And it said that he invented John Wayne, and the John Wayne character from the Ringo Kid through the Searchers is a pretty stoic, arguably violent, but powerful, a man of few words, a man of action. And Ford put his stamp, I think, on the Western by suggesting that there was a certain cowboy code. Cowboys were kind to women and children. Cowboys were patriotic. Cowboys were respectful of elderly people and authority, and they knew how to handle themselves. Instead of picking up a phone call and dialing 911, the law was 3 days right away, they would often take circumstances into their own hands and, of course, complete the conflict within a two-hour film. So that's part of a simple beginning of the codification, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I'd take it further back because I think it comes directly out of the Civil War, because there's a tradition, Beatles dime novels, which were the things that people carried, you know, the young soldiers are carrying in their back pockets during the Civil War, where characters like Calamity Jane and Buffalo Bill and all those folks. And I think you can see a direct line from that sort of complete literary fiction to things like Owen Wister's The Virginian, which is right at the turn of the century, and that feeds directly into that John Wayne image. So it never seemed to come out of actual cowboys, which is kind of interesting. There's a sort of literary trope about it, but there aren't any really model cowboys. Maybe Teddy Roosevelt is a model cowboy.
Mm. Yeah, I think what the dime novels and the movie tradition for the cowboy culture leaves behind is the diversity that existed. You know, the fact that a lot of it is derived from Spanish and Hispanic cultures. African American cowboys are all but absent in that tradition, and so we lose a lot of the texture, the richness of what actually happened in the American West in terms of cowboys.
I mean, what are the real bases for the fictionalized cowboy, because it is related to this sort of frontier notion of living on the frontier and moving out west and being that solitary figure. What are the factual bases for this codification that has appeared in film and literature, etc.?
Well, there was an actual cattle industry, and they actually needed people to. Well, they stole horses from Mexico, and then they brought them north and sold them in the Chicago railheads and places like that. So cowboys were responsible for taking the purloined animals and getting them north. And that involved a lot of, you know, individual stick-to-itiveness and, you know, all of those kinds of things. But these were really hard-working people who were part of a corporate industry, which is another part we seem to leave behind about this. And I think Matt's right. There are a lot of Hispanic men, there are a lot of African-American men, and there are a lot of shell-shocked Civil War soldiers. I think that's the other piece. So the people who lit out for the territories after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying it's an industry, but am I hearing you right? It's an industry of theft?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, it's also trying to capitalize or commoditize the vast open space of the American West and try to figure out how to turn prairie land into a paying proposition. And so using the grass that grows out here naturally, although very slim relative to other parts of the country, to turn that into beef that you can ship elsewhere and turn a profit on.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, obviously the film genre or the films came about post-Civil War, obviously, but the Western itself was an actual early genre of film. Why do you think that filmmakers sort of latched on to that notion of the Western for film?
Well, that's a good question. I've heard it said that if films were religion, we would get the most out of Westerns because they were simple morality plays, good and evil. The beginning of the Western was, I think they were called oaters, O-A-T-E-R-S, or horse operas, derisively, meaning that many of them had very simple narrative structures. There might be a robbery or a stagecoach holdup, and then a cowboy might sing a song on his horse and take off after the outlaws and bring them back to justice. Later, that would kind of erode and become more vengeance-seeking than justice-seeking, but that was a corruption of the original code, I would say. But I think people like Ford felt that that was satisfactory in the beginning for them to be that simplistic and basic morality tales, but he was interested in doing something, I think, a little more with a narrative form, mm-hmm. And he did.
An example?
I think The Searchers is a good example of kind of that cowboy code, the simplistic cowboy code becoming somewhat more darkened, more arguably corrupt, where Ethan Edwards' character becomes somewhat pathological by the end of the film and seems to want one thing. But I don't know that that's the question you asked exactly.
That's okay. Let the answer go where it may. So, yeah. Did you, Anne?
Well, I wondered one big shift that I think maybe happens in the 1930s, and maybe this has to have to do with sound or whatever, but the landscape all of a sudden becomes really important. So in a film like The Searchers or Stagecoach or any of those John Ford ones, all of a sudden you see that very iconic Western landscape, which in the early Odors, I don't think that was – the landscape didn't play as much of a role.
Some of the original Westerns were shot in Florida, believe it or not. And then as the country kind of expanded west, the film industry expanded west. And, I think there is something to Ford's notion that he wanted to shoot, you know, real men, real violence, realistically in real locations. So I think eight or ten of his films were shot in the Monument Valley, which is very much based on the iconography. Sound was part of it, but certainly the competition from television forced the film industry to move to larger formats to bring people out to the theaters, and we had Vista Vision then and, you know, large cinematic events. And yeah, if you've ever seen The Searchers in Blu-ray or on a 40-foot diagonal screen, you are seeing, you know, combination travel log and action film, beautifully shot.
Why did the land become such an iconic character?
Well, I think some might argue that it probably has to do with this idea that there is no longer a frontier. And Frederick Jackson Turner and what he called the frontier thesis, that the frontier closed in the 1890s. You no longer had open space that you could seek out and reinvent yourself. And I think it's a sentimentalizing of that idea that you could always move west. Well, after that time, according to the frontier thesis, you couldn't. I think those movies and the dime novels that preceded them were this idea of an escape valve, a place you could go to, move to, and with the closing of the West, the closing of the frontier, that is, that no longer exists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's something inherently powerful about having a stranger ride in from the frontier or from nature and up here again on a 40-foot diagonal screen, and he's set in a very isolated image. I mean, the frame shows him as a couple of pixels by today's comparison in what is a vast, expansive, sometimes vertical, but a horizon that goes on forever. So that gives you that sense that if something happens to him, if he's attacked by savages, he'll likely be savaged by the time it's over.
Well, you bring up The Searchers, and since we're on the topic of land, I want to, I think with the Searchers, and I think with Colorado Springs, the actual physical location of southern Colorado, there's a lot of different landscapes present here. There's the plains out to the east, which homes would be the homesteader place, and then you've got the cities like Colorado Springs, but you've got the landscape of the mesas and the buttes and things like that. And I'm wondering how if those differences and then you've got the miners, of course. I'm wondering if those differences of occupation, landscape, played a role in the characterization, or if they didn't really matter.
In the characterization of the land?
Well, if the land played a role in the characterization of the myth.
Oh, okay.
If those differences, or was it just whatever was to use whatever's convenient? Or
well, in the myth piece, those Western towns mixed all of those things, because if you looked in the sort of classic bar scene, there's some miners sitting around, and there's some ranchers sitting around, and there's some Indians lurking in the corner, but it's all in one place, which is not true in the actual real West, because mining towns are in very particular places that have to do with where the deposits are, and ranchers live in places where you can actually grow stuff. And usually those two things aren't in the same area.
But the myth would put them all together.
Yeah, smush it.
Mm-hmm. So that smushing, let's deconstruct that a little bit here in southern Colorado.
Well, I mean, what you find here is you have all these iconic themes going on in southern Colorado. So you definitely have miners, both hard rock and coal mining going on. You've definitely got cattle trails, which are a big part of this, where the myth comes from, is moving cattle from, you know, pasture to trailhead or railroad head. You've got settlements and communities being evolving around places where you can farm or where there's other industry. So it's more distinct. These things happen because of geography or because of climate, as Anne was saying. And so you can find them, but you don't find them the way you find them in movies, as she said, all smushed together.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Kim, in movies and in media, that particular differentiation between the landscapes doesn't really matter, that it's all a part of one whole?
Well, I think it matters for the reason Anne mentions. When people come to town, you tend to see a kind of diverse community that juxtaposes with the cowboy, the loner, the person living out there sleeping with his horse, who might come to town for a haircut or an occasional bath if he's forced to move into that domestic sphere. But I think part of it this is going to sound glib, and I don't mean it to. Elmore Leonard is interviewed, and he said, the reason I wrote about One Street Towns is because they were easy to write about, because I could put all these people in a setting within a frame that I could manage dramatically in a one-hour television series or a two-hour feature. So that, I think, is part of it is, you know, efficiency, dramatic efficiency.
Just wanted to interject a question. Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, Deadwood, The Wild Bunch, these movies and television shows and books that very deliberately poke holes in our conception of Western mythology. How true are these things, or how much are they just reacting to the myth?
Let me reiterate that. I'm going to simplify it a little bit.
That's fine.
I want to go back for a second, though. Anne, did you have something you wanted to say to that last point, talking about the bringing together of the different miners and the...
Well, I think there's always a sense that the West, and we always use that term as if we know what we're talking about, and it's just this vague thing that we talk about with not much meaning. Mm-hmm. But it's a stage. And, I mean, there's some wonderful images from the 1870s. There's one by John Gast called American Progress. And it's the sort of stage where there are stagecoaches and covered wagons and Indians and miners all, you know, tromping across. So that notion that this is this place where all of these things can coexist, I think, has been powerful for a long time.
Well, how does that not come off as silly then? You know, if you're throwing together all of these elements that are actually separate, how does that not come off as cliche or ridiculous?
I think it probably does.
Yeah, I think it probably does, too. You know, in My Darling Clementine, one of the earlier Ford films, it's not that heavy-handed. He will just show in the background of shots this so-called orderly march of progress where people will come in their covered wagons and they'll have trappings of the East Coast in their wagons. They'll erect churches. You'll hear a church bell in the background, for example. And that becomes a kind of, I think, a safe haven for people to either stay and occupy and colonize or to press on. So, I think it's consistent with what you're saying. We don't really – I mean, this is John Ford's version of the West, and for many of us, that is the West. The Cormac McCarthy trilogy kind of – again, sours the mythology to a great extent because you have people who are trafficking in scalps, which these are people who represent authoritarian figures, our own cavalry, for example, or the movement of the railroad through the West in ways that we've not seen it until Deadwood or until some of the more postmodern films question the myth and try to puncture the myth, I think, deliberately, brilliantly in his case.
So are they – you say you use the phrase puncturing the myth. Are they bringing truth back to that myth?
Well, I think there's been – these films were made within a very strict code All right. The Hays Code said that you couldn't create audience sympathy toward any wrongdoing, evil, or sin. That seems, and it is, an arcane notion when you watch something like Deadwood or when you read something like Blood Meridian, because, or No Country for Old Men, that film could not have been made, you know, under the Hays Code. So there was a sanitizing of the myth that was consistently put out for audiences for entertainment purposes. It just became interpreted, I think, by a lot of people as the reality of what the West was.
And you're saying sanitizing, making it more about a duality, would that be a correct? Go ahead.
I'm not sure I can.
Well, maybe it's the opposite. So there's the West of opportunity, and then the sort of postmodern view is the sort of West of terrible disappointment and evil, and what people do when they're frustrated and angry and don't have any resources. And the West, I mean, statistically, is way more violent than the rest of the nation. That's actually true. I'm not sure why, but that's been true for a long time. So suicide rates, rural shootings, all of that sort of stuff is actually true.
Yeah, these things, the Johnson County wars between, you know, people who herd sheep and people who herd cattle is true, and that's portrayed in John Ford movies. So there is a hint of truth. I always think, though, that this pop culture is more about interpreting the times in which it's created than it is about the actual history that's supposed to be portrayed. You know, so you'll see a very different portrayal of American Indian people in Little Big Man than you would in a John Ford movie, and that just reflects the times in which it's created.
You know, one of the, I don't know if romanticized is the correct word, but I think one of the most romanticized conflicts of the American West is that between cowboys versus Indians, you know, and I'm wondering, obviously there are significant clashes like the Sand Creek Massacre, but what's the reality of this area? Is that something that, what was happening here?
Do you really want us to answer that question?
Yes, I do.
Go for it, Ann.
Well, one thing, there were no cowboys ever fighting Indians. That's really silly. There were military men fighting Indians. There were settlers sometimes fighting Indians. But cowboys and Indians, I have no idea how that ever came about. So we could stop there. But here, Colorado was a place that could not be settled until the military came in and removed the Indians. So they used reservations. They used blunt force. There were almost no reservations in Colorado compared to other places. The Arapaho and the Cheyenne on the Front Range were shipped off to Indian territory. So it was made into a blank stage for homesteaders and cities by active force. And Sand Creek is a piece of that.
You said it could not be settled, but so that leads me to believe that there were hostilities towards the settlers who were coming in.
Well, Matt, we just finished commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Gold Rush, and so I'm going to put it in that perspective. The Gold Rush was about trying to get out here, extract the gold, and then initially go home. It wasn't so much about settlement of Colorado in the very first blush of it. And in that first rush period, 1859, I don't know of any examples of conflicts between those people who are settling the state coming here to seek gold and the American Indians who had treaty rights to the territory. What changes that dynamic is after a year goes by, or after 2 years goes by, and these people aren't leaving. And so it's this idea of treaty obligations, treaty rights to land, that is then being settled by an influx of people who are not taking the gold and leaving. They're staying and they're settling, and you get communities established. And you get people who are creating ranches to serve the miners who are up in the mountains. And it's this creation of society, creation of a territory, that really forces that issue. And a decision has to be made, you know, who's going to stay and who's going to go. And it's the American Indians who go. Mm-hmm.
There's a yeah. wonderful biography of Chief Left Hand, and there are a couple of great stories there. He in 1859 sort of realizes what's going on. He's a leader of the Southern Arapaho, so he takes a tour, and he goes to Kansas and Missouri to check out who's coming. And he gets very nervous and comes back home and warns everybody about what's going to happen. And that's supposedly the first real confrontation, is that winter when he comes back and he runs into a group of miners just right around Boulder. And they have the sort of first actual confrontation where Chief Left Hand says, "This is our camping spot. It has been for years. This is where we winter, and you can't stay." And this is the first time they have a fight over winter camping grounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have those kind of instances happening right here in the Pikes Peak region with settlers who are living in Colorado City and conflicts between them and the Arapaho and the Cheyenne. And, you know, so it is part of our tradition. But to go back to the original question, it's not really part of the cowboy tradition. In actuality,
the cowboy and Indian is this duality, though, in film. And I'm wondering, you know, Kim, as somebody who studies the film industry, is that just a product of convenience?
Ask me that again, and I'll see if I can answer that as a yes or no, or if it's something beyond my grasp.
This notion of the cowboys and Indians, as we're just talking about, or cowboys versus Indians, is sort of this myth that didn't really exist, but yet in film it was one of the main plot points. Was that just a product of convenience?
It makes great action. I mean, if you've heard an arrow whistling through the air, or you've listened to the pounding of war drums, I think that's very dramatic. In the hands of John Ford, at least, it's a pretty poetic statement. It's a chase scene. So is it real? I don't know. The things I've read about the real violence in the West are not nearly as dramatic as staging a shootout at the OK Corral, where two people come up and confront one another face to face after they've walked down a long expanse of one town street. I mean, that's pretty powerful drama. If indeed people are shot in the back of the head as they enjoy a drink at a bar, that's over pretty quickly and is not as easy to edit, I guess, or costume or block or shoot. I think it does make for good chase scenes. It seems overly simple, but many of those films were pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking... To what extent, you know, they always say that what drove a lot of the conflict with the American Indian people was the coming of the railroad, which tends to divide up the buffalo herds. I don't know, I'm mainly asking this of Anne, to what extent fencing off the range did the same thing of keeping herds from moving from one place to the other and following what had been kind of natural migration patterns for both people and animals. Did that play a role?
Well, I think a whole bunch of things happen all at once that are bad for Native people. And mostly it's just settlement and the whole package of those things, which of course involves railroads, involves urban areas, involves new ideas about how land is used. So the notion of sharing a landscape becomes impossible because you can't own a plot. You're, you know, 640 acres and share it with an Indian group who comes and goes on it. So I think it's not a simple answer. There are a bunch of strands there.
One of the enduring plot lines in Westerns is barbed wire. You know, the stoic, I hate wire, because free range becomes suddenly made into personal and private property, and that's a conflict for somebody who's accustomed to running cattle over free range. Again, makes great drama.
No.
The question would be the journals of Lewis and Clark.
And of course, there's the story of Lewis and Clark and their trip out west. And there's the iconic friendly narrative of them going out and being friendly and then coming back and everything's great. Why didn't that kind of thing take hold? Why is this conflict?
because they were just moving through. They weren't setting up society in the West. They were exploring and moving on, and so there isn't the conflict over land. I think that's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Indian people have power in the West as long as they have real use and real things that other people need and want. So if they have information, if they have land, if they have power to fight against another group, they have value. And it's all of a sudden when Indian ways of being in the world don't have value that we see something else happen. And I don't think that's really until the 1860s, which you could tie to the Homestead Act and railroads again.
Kim, anything?
The myth of the agrarian paradise does play into some of the Western narratives. That Shane is a good example of where a guy starts. He's actually named Start, and he finds a small homestead or a small parcel to homestead, and there's a creek or water, clear water running through it, and he starts a little garden and brings all the trappings of the East there, and they have their china dishes, and so dramatically it represents a real threat then when they're when ranchers come in and try to fence them off that free range. But again, it seems like such a simplistic narrative because we accept it on that level. I mean, we really don't try to look very deep into the causes. It's entertainment. It's not really.
And in contrast to Lewis and Clark, I would bring up Pike, who's our guy, and his journals create this idea of the Great American Desert, and the West is a place that cannot support society as we know it in the East, in the settled East. And so, and I think that serves as an inhibitor to Western settlement. How dry the West is, and that you can't just plunk down and farm 40 acres or 20 acres or 10 acres. You just can't do that in the West. And so that serves to prohibit or to delay settlement and the conflict that arises and the myth that comes out of that.
You just mentioned about Zebulon Pike. The West is something that cannot support the life that we're used to, if that's what I heard you say. If Colorado Springs started with this notion of being such a high-class society in the West, a high-class society place, people to come vacation who have money, was the community isolated from the elements of Colorado at that time, the elements that the notion that you had to wipe out so that we could come settle and those sorts of things, were they isolated from the elements that contributed to creating sort of these frontier values?
I think Colorado Springs it's hard to draw conclusions on a larger scale from it because it was such a planned community from its very beginning with a very clear vision as what it was going to be. So a resort town, a place that would be attractive to people of means. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't, again, those iconic things going on all around. We were a little bit of pocket, protected from, the changes in the economy that affected cattle ranching, where, eventually you get the railroads, you get refrigerated boxcars, and you don't need to drive cattle across the plains anymore. The technology and the economy changes. I'm getting trapped in my own dialogue here. I don't know. You go ahead, Ann.
Well, but Colorado Springs wouldn't have existed without mining because, I mean, somebody like General Palmer who came, the reason they wanted railroads in Colorado is because they wanted easier ways to get ore and they needed to produce coal. So there's a whole industrial base that allows this sort of planned resort community to exist kind of on top of it. So, I mean, and General Palmer planned it that way very carefully, that Colorado Springs would be protected and sort of Pueblo and communities like that would have the more industrial cast to it all.
Mm-hmm. So was it insulated then from events that could have led up to, say, the Sand Creek Massacre? Was it a separate community?
Well, it wasn't here at that time, so it's a little bit, anachronistic to think about that. But, I mean, it is a pocket in that just 2 miles to the west of Colorado Springs is Colorado City, which is much more traditional Western boomtown, relying on agriculture and later on gold processing plants. And so it wasn't very isolated. It was only isolated by maybe a mile to all these other activities that are perhaps much more symbolic of what was happening in the American West.
Mm-hmm. But it's another way of recreating yourself if you have tuberculosis,
yes,
or all of those kinds of Eastern maladies. You can come breathe the fresh high altitude air and remake yourself in another form. So maybe that's part of that.
Well, at one point there was the notion that they were going to reject this whole if I remember this correctly, the notion that they did not want to be associated with anything Western, that they wanted to be the highbrow community in the West. But then later on, they came and they embraced those Western values. Where did that shift come from, and where did they find those values if they were never really a part of them in the first place?
Well, I think there were some of these values because we have wealthy people like a Teddy Roosevelt, but he wasn't here. But these stories of elite Easterners who want to set up these little ranching operations out on the plains. So you do have that kind of ideal of coming out west and being a gentleman rancher. So that is there. But we did try to, you look at our street design, you look at our architecture, you look at our laws and the anti-liquor laws that were here. Those were all a reaction to the idea of what a Western town was like, and definitely steered us away from that. Where it changes, I think, is with pop culture and the things that bring about the Western movie. We're fascinated with this idea of the West, and so we move from the flower parade to an event called the Shawn Keeve, which kept some of the flower parade ideas but added American Indians and cowboys. And then we jump into it wholeheartedly with the Pike's Peak or Bust Rodeo.
What, can you spell the Shawn Keeve?
S-H, and I always say it wrong, so I think I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's S-H-A-N. K-I-V-E.
Isn't it Shawn Keeve?
Keeve, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and Kim, I do want to know if, there are these pockets of Eastern thought in these Western films, if that kind of a mentality shows up in any of those films.
The narrow characterization of women is one of the things that's often talked about in Westerns, and by that I mean women were either saloon girls or they were school marms oftentimes, or mothers. I think that's, leading in that direction. The depiction is often described as either whore or nun, and in My Darling Clementine, you have both. You have a woman named Chihuahua who works in a saloon, and she cheats at cards, and she's very sultry and tries to win the affections of Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. And then you have Clementine, who really doesn't enter the film until about 40 minutes in. And then she has her own theme music, and she's from back east, and she's trailing after Doc Holliday to try to bring him back away from Chihuahua's clutches and make him a respectable doctor back east again. So maybe speaking to the issue of coming out here to reinvent oneself, I think Doc Holliday is kind of trying to escape the domestic encumbrance of his relationship with Clementine in the east and come back out and be a wild, rugged individualist where he can live and be free. Another Western myth, I think.
You're talking about some of these characterizations, pre-westward expansion, and by westward expansion, I mean en masse. Obviously there was a period of long-time exploration. Are there stories from that time that sort of somehow pick up – some of the characteristics can be linked directly back to pre civilization, quote
well,
unquote.
You could look at a place, maybe, like Bent's Fort, which is, you know, founded in the 1830s. But it's this is much more like the Lewis and Clark story, because this is a place where all kinds of people met. In fact, Bent is married to a Native woman. There's a whole history of various people marrying various people. And there's no competition over land. It's when Anglo-American notions of property and what land is used for come in, that all shifts. But I think that notion of the fort, where people came together, where, I mean, that's a true borderland. It's right on the Arkansas River. There are Mexican people, there are Anglo people, and there are, you know, a lot of Native people. So there's, maybe that's a version of this that's local.
I have one more question to inject somewhere, which is that why, with Garden of the Gods and everything, why didn't Colorado Springs end up becoming iconic Western movie landscape as opposed to, like, Monument Valley? Which was the John Ford, the iconic John Ford.
It's actually a great I don't know if you, any of you attended the PPLD symposium, but there was a great lecture as part of that about how Colorado Springs, they tried to make this into a film central, and it, whatever, I don't know that I know exactly why it didn't. I'm sure it's economy, but the effort was there. So
Ford was a heavy drinker. It may have been.
Yeah, there you go.
I want to go back for a minute to something that you just said, Anne, which kind of struck me as a little bit odd, which is that it wasn't until, and I think I forget the latter half of what you said, but it wasn't until the Anglo-American notions of land and land ownership that came into this area that these conflicts arose and that these issues arose. Is that correct? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, I think this goes back to creating a blank slate for Anglo-American action, and that's around property values.
I think that stands in a really interesting contrast with the whole notion of the cowboy drifter, though, who doesn't own property, who doesn't own land, who visits but never stays. And I'm wondering how that particular piece of the cowboy notion or the drifter notion sort of co-opted these other values that weren't really a part of the Anglo-American experience.
I wonder if it has all to do with getting away from women. Because that's so central to that cowboy story. And if you own land and you have a farm, it's going to become Little House on the Prairie, and the women are going to come and there'll be children and you have to stick around. So if you don't own land and you drift from place to place, you can stay in this place where Eastern values and domesticity and all those things don't come and ruin your life. Mm-hmm.
Kim?
I agree that that's really part of that myth of freedom, that you get to come in and leave when you want, and you know, you can be the reluctant hero and you can make things right in Shane, or you can make things right in My Darling Clementine, or you can make things right in The Searchers, and then leave in some ways because you may be unfit to live in that domestic sphere, but at least in part because that domestic life is an encumbrance to your freedom. It doesn't allow you to come and go. Some of those trappings, it's often referred to as a threat, the threat of domesticity. So it plays into the mythology. We don't want to look at it very deeply. Or we'll see these, you know, Western heroes, Western outlaw people for perhaps what they are. But they are easy to identify with, I think. For those people in the 1950s who are feeling some of the encumbrance of moving to the suburbs and raising their 2.2 children and working in a factory, or this really is a very appealing, a very attractive myth.
So do you think that particular notion regarding the popular the popular notion surrounding that of a cowboy as a drifter arises out of the constraints of the 50s, as opposed to, you know, actually being a specific characteristic?
Well, part of the mythology I've heard, the first millionaire writer in America apparently was Zane Grey, And part of his Western mythology was to incorporate a great deal of adventure, and he himself would come from back east and spend time in Arizona and, you know, raft down these exciting white water rivers and then go back and extrapolate that to some fantastic narrative. But, I think for people who felt that domestic life was laden with boredom and their existence was somewhat boring, I think I would want to go to the Westerns and go to the drive-in and see a Western.
Yeah.
I mean, another thing that gets invented at exactly the same time that I think serves the same needs are things like the Boy Scouts, the Indian Scouts, and summer camps. All those summer camps that are in the Colorado Rockies that are about sort of reclaiming your...
Dude ranches.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not probably an accident that the popularity of Westerns tended to pop up. Some experts have said when we needed to see the American male as virile and powerful, there was some relationship to what was going on internationally with our involvement in the Second World War and the Korean War, that these myths helped to explain the myth of manifest destiny and the myth of colonization and why we're involved as deeply as we are. It's an attractive entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that period reinvents the West itself. I mean, the West is serving as a kind of a guidepost for the 1950s, but then the 1950s reinvents the West with the atomic West and nuclear experimentation and the development of the A-bomb and the testing that happens in Nevada. And that, you know, brings a lot of people out here and you know, creates many of the cities that we know today.
I'm going to kind of repeat what Noel's question was earlier, which is, you know, with Colorado Springs sort of being surrounded by this landscape of, you've got the Garden of the Gods and you've got to the east is the prairie. Why didn't it end up becoming a Western landscape for film?
Well, I know there's some research going on about that and the study that study of the fact that it was used extensively for film, but never really quite hit it off the same way Monument Valley did. Am I saying that right? Monument Valley.
You know, that was an extraordinary endeavor on Ford's part. He was 150 miles from the nearest railroad. In order to create realism in the films, he would force his people to live in tents. I can't remember the community that's there, but there's a very small single hotel. And it's really not a hotel at all. It's a bunch of tents. He would cover his actors in dust, and if they took the dust off them, you know, he'd yell at them. But some of it, a lot of it is infrastructure. I mean, he had to build the sets that he made there, but he really exploited the natural environment. It's a chore to travel to bring a circus act of feature film scale out to the desert like that. I mean... He received most of his money, you know, from Hollywood. That's really the driving engine.
Well, and I wonder if it didn't have more to do with, or something to do with how well known the Pikes Peak region was in film, still film. I mean, it was William Henry Jackson, and you know, this was a great place to come out and capture the landscape on film, and it would have been well known, whereas, you know, other places in the West, you know, would have been new, unusual, have a new visual impact to it. I don't know if that's it or not. But.
In terms of iconography, there's more interest in the buttes that you see in Monument Valley that have now become kind of recognizable in a variety of commercials as well as Westerns. Versus this, which, I mean, just in terms of scale, at some point you get far enough away to shoot Pike's Peak, and you're so far away that it, you know, it's this kind of monolith. If you go back through and you break down individual frames of the Searchers, it is, again, it's a more beautiful shot that's broken up by these kind of tall vertical. They look they've been described as sort of religious in their statuesque elements. This place wouldn't, I don't think, look quite as good. And probably by the time Ford was shooting, there would have been power lines to deal with, things that make practical shooting. We didn't have After Effects then that we could dodge out all of the trappings of civilization.
And
maybe just the sort of practical issue of who owned it, because Garden of the Gods was privately owned, so you would have had to go through all kinds of rigmarole to get access to it. And Monument Valley's in a place, it's on federal land, so you can pretty much do what you want. So I think that probably makes a difference too.
And he would pay, I guess it's the Navajos, he would pay them scale as actors, the same kind of money they would have made if they lived in Hollywood, and they felt that was a, you know, a great trade-off. And he would build a set, and he'd leave them that, and he would tell them, oh, it's worth $250,000. You're going to want to, you know, keep this. It's really going to be valuable to you. And there's some shysterism going on there, certainly. But I think that would have been a tougher sell in this area. A little more sophistication.
I want to go back. I want to re-ask a question that I asked earlier, which is, you know, regarding the the Anglo-American expansion westward. What kinds of things were going on at that time that sort of have trickled through to our identity today as Coloradans, as Colorado Springsians? Is that correct? What are some of those things that have sort of trickled through that made their mark?
Hispanic traditions? I mean, we're at the very northern edge of the arc of Spanish influence, but really a little beyond it. I think the Arkansas River really is a border, but, I mean, water use, acequias, land grants.
And I think I want to go back to, you know, the idea that this was an Anglo-American tradition of settling land, because you had the same competition in northern New Spain, as it would have been called at the time, where Comanche raiders were going in and raiding Spanish colonial villages. And one of my favorite scenes I'd love to see portrayed in film is Dianza and his Spanish colonial cavalry chasing Comanche and their chief, Cuerno Verde, coming down Ute Pass, right through downtown Colorado Springs, and heading down south to where there's a decisive battle between Spanish and American Indians. So you've got this happening in different cultures as well. And, you know, so it's not just after settlement, after the discovery of gold in Colorado, but it's part of this ongoing kind of European attitude about land versus the indigenous people. So that's off topic.
Another great story.
Well, I think, I think it's, well, I think that brings up an important notion, which is that the area was in conflict long before the westward expansion, the American westward expansion, actually started. I'm just wondering, you know, if those kinds of notions come through at all necessarily within what the identity is of the area, of the region.
I'm not quite sure how to answer that. because I think, you know, I don't know that people who live in this, I can't speak for them. Mm-hmm. Certainly as historians, I think we're aware of it. You know, how much it becomes part of our identity, I can't really say. I mean, I think, you know, I think an answer to that might be in 3 years when we commemorate the 150th anniversary of Sand Creek. I think that's going to be a theme that gets replayed. And I think there's still some reckoning to do with that. You know, I think you go up to Cripple Creek today and you see the huge open pit mine. And I think that talks about land use. And that conversation happens. I think as we settle the community and then we get out into the suburbs, I think people are less directly connected to their own history. And that's part of being in a transient community that we are. So I don't know.
Kind of shifting gears just a little bit, which is, is it of equal historical imagery to want to, you know, go buy a sheriff's badge in a tourist shop versus buying a rubber tomahawk versus panning for gold as a tourist activity? Are those equal in what they mean and what they indicate?
Well, in a kid's mind, I think the issue is they're actually all the same. And I think that's our job as educators to sort of untangle some of those things. I mean, what does a tomahawk actually mean? What does it mean when people do the tomahawk chop in a football stadium? That means something different because of this history of conquest. But I think in popular culture, it doesn't. And I think that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I guess I'm kind of bummed because I have been keeping an eye on the watch as well, and I really did want to go back to this notion of the flower parade and the evolution of the flower, because I just watched the big something regarding it, and it was, you know, the flower parade, which is a real elaborate parade through the Garden of the Gods to show that things can grow here, correct?
Up and down Tejon Street.
Up and down Tejon Street to show that things could actually grow here. And then, there's sort of this I call it kind of a horrible Halloween of costuming that eventually becomes the Pike Peak or Bust Rodeo, and I'm just wondering about that evolution there, how that happened.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with all of the thing that weaves them all together is marketing the community and getting people to partly to celebrate community, partly create an identity for the community. And so when it was the flower parade, it was that we are an elite community, that we're focused on, we have the luxury to focus on flower gardening. And the flowers were all about, taking the abundance of flowers you have in your garden and decorating your carriage and then taking it downtown street. And when it becomes the Pike's Peak or Bust Rodeo, it's about, marketing ourselves as a true Western community. And I'm going to put true in quotes. And trying to connect ourselves to that iconic past, whether or not we fit very well into that.
Anne?
Well, maybe there's a way to go back to what you said earlier, that in fact Pike was right. It is the great American almost desert, and it's really hard to grow things here. So that flower parade is as much a myth as anything else. I mean, one of my favorite things to think about is the whole Little House on the Prairie story, because that's really an accurate portrayal of what happened with the Homestead Act. Because Pa Ingalls, if you think one second, why did he have to move all the time? Because he kept failing. In every landscape, he kept failing. And really the only place the Ingalls family ever made it was in town, when they finally gave up on all that homestead stuff and moved into town. Because it's really hard to grow things in these places. So,
and the comparison that I often use is, I've got two great photos that I use back-to-back, one of Greeley, Colorado, which established at the same time as Colorado Springs, but with a very different vision. It was an agricultural commune, and there prominently portrayed is their irrigation canal, and they're irrigating crops. Here, one of the first things we do is we create the El Paso Canal, also a prominent irrigation supply, and what we water are trees and lawns and flowers to create a place that will be attractive to people. And that's very different from this idea of the iconic West. It's a different theme altogether.
Mm-hmm. I guess finally, why is this image of the cowboy in the West so pervasive? And I'm not just talking about a piece of national identity. It's also internationally associated with what the United States of America is. Why is that?
Well, Hollywood had a lot to do with it. I mean, it was systematically put out there. Probably 150 or 200 Westerns a year, all following a similar form of a stoic, powerful, often violent, appropriately violent would be one interpretation, of real men who stood for something was the idea. And that became, it became an easily, you know, America's cinema became world cinema in part because they were very effective and efficient at production, distribution, and exhibition of these films. They were made within a code, which meant that they became pretty cliche. If you were to look back at them now, it would be impossible to look at them without some serious sense of irony. But they were effective.
I mean, is that the sole reason?
Well, it's a positive story about progress hitched to this absolutely appealing, virile story. So what's not to like about that?
I think it embodies freedom, sentimentality, kind of a connection to the past, and this idea of reinvention, the way we started this conversation.
Great. I think that's it. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.